This is Arnold Michaelis. On the 14th of July, 1957, I spent the day at the Valkill cottage of Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt in Hyde Park, New York. After luncheon on the porch, we settled down in the library for an informal talk and soon found ourselves discussing Mrs. Roosevelt's first lecture meeting last winter with the inmates of the Women's House of Detention in New York City. I recalled the warm rapport Mrs. Roosevelt had established with the inmates, telling them the story of an earlier visit she had made to a prison. She told the story again for my benefit.
Well, Maury Maverick was in charge at that time of all production in prisons, and he asked if I would go and see the prisoners doing this work. And I was going over for him one morning to Baltimore, and I had to get up very early to go, so I didn't go in to say good morning to my husband. And when he came out to go over to the office out of his room, he passed my secretary, Mrs. Thompson's room, and he called out to her, "Tommy, where is my missus?" And Miss Thompson said, "Oh, Mr. President, didn't you know she's gone to prison?" And he said, "She has? What for?" With no surprise at all. And Miss Thompson explained. But he thought it was quite natural I'd gone to prison.
Well, didn't he say anything about bailing you out?
No, not a word. Not a word. He was just going to find out why I was in prison.
Well, Mrs. Roosevelt, those years in the White House, on the whole, you thought you lived those years very impersonally, and that it was almost as if you had erected someone a little outside of yourself who paraded as the president's wife.
Yes, I think, I don't know how other people would be, but you have to realize that I grew up a very shy person, and that suddenly to be taken into a world where you live in a goldfish bowl, where everybody knows everything you do, where you have a press conference once a week, because on the whole it's better to tell people the truth. And actually, the period is such that it's important that they should get the feeling that the White House was very close to the people. It's quite a difficult adjustment for anybody. And I think the way I made it was to simply look upon myself as a sort of symbol of what you represented to the country. You were, the entertainment was not your entertainment. It was the country's entertainment. Therefore, the hospitality given was the hospitality of the country. Much of what you did was done as a symbol of what the White House meant to the country. It represented the people's house, where they, as a whole, as a nation, dispensed hospitality to foreigners, to Americans of note, and your life, at least the formal part of your life, became something a little outside of yourself. Now, you had a private life, of course, but that life that was the life of things that had to be done was a very impersonal life.
I was so touched when you said that you were lost somewhere deep down inside of yourself. When did you get over that feeling?
Well, I don't know that I ever did quite, because I never got away from being in the public eye, more or less, because even after I left the White House, every time I went out, somebody spoke to me. And it wasn't for me, it was because of my husband. And I couldn't go in a subway or stand on a street corner without people collecting, and I very soon came to realize that this was probably going to be a permanent thing. Now, I suppose it arose from the fact that I had been longer in the White House than anybody else, and that there had been such endless photographs, and that we had been through two great crises, one a financial crisis and one a war. That made people center much more on the White House than they otherwise would have done. And that I had done a number of things which perhaps were different from what other women in the White House had done because of the difference in circumstances. Mrs. Coolidge, for instance, had been a lovely person whom everyone who knew had deep affection for. But the times when she was in Washington were times when the presidency was really rather distant from the people. They didn't need to appeal. Things were going along rather uninterestingly, but calmly. And therefore, there was no need to do anything different. And I think probably the circumstances of the years that we had been in the White House are what created the fact that people recognized me so readily, and then the fact that I stayed doing things and never dropped out of the public eye. It's very easy to drop out of the public eye. If I had dropped everything I was doing and just either lived in New York quietly or here quietly, I could have dropped out of the public eye and reached a point in a few years where nobody would have recognized me anywhere. But that seemed to me a very uninteresting thing to do. I had work that I was doing, and it interested me to go on with it. And I had felt all along that if I did do that, I would become a burden to my children, because they would all feel, oh, my poor mother, I must go and see her. And there's one thing I've never wanted to be, is a burden to my children. And so I just went to work to fill my life as much as possible. And I succeeded rather perhaps better than I really intended. And the result has been that the children occasionally say they wish I were less busy, but at least they don't feel that I'm any burden.
Well, I've always felt this about you. It has been so interesting. We're all familiar with your shyness engendered ever since you were a child. And yet, with all your shyness, you've gone on to become known in the hearts of practically everybody throughout the world as the First Lady of the world. Now, your shyness apparently has never been able to cope with your energy. And I think for that reason, your energy has pushed your shyness into the background.
Well, I think the way I got over that was by this feeling of not being quite myself, of being something a little different. When people, for instance, talk about the First Lady of the world, I never feel that that is really me. I always feel it's just someone who happened to be my husband's wife and happened to have a lot of things happen to them. But it's more or less the feeling that it's outside of you as a person. The personality that you have manufactured, and therefore you can do it.
I think that, as you say, deep down inside, that you were lost somewhere. I don't think that you ever really were lost. I think you merely had let your energy direct you along the lines of what you felt you had to do at every specific point.
Well, I think that may be true, that you just went along the lines. Of course, I was brought up in a rather peculiar way. I was brought up, first of all, by my grandmother, who thought really of life only from the social point of view.
Yes.
But she had a tremendous sense of obligation about your social life. And so there was a certain discipline about that. You didn't say that you felt ill or that you felt tired, because it made you unpleasant to the people you were with. And if you were unhappy or anything, you didn't tell anybody. You bore it alone. And then I always remember once telling my little grandson, my daughter's son, Buzzy, when he was a little boy, he was a very sensitive little boy, and he was living with us in the White House when we first went down there. And his sister would often make him feel badly, and he would cry because she could do so many more things. She was the eldest. So one day I found him crying in the hall, the second floor. And I said, oh, Buzzy, we don't cry where people are. We go and cry by ourselves. Now, you find a bathtub and go and cry into it. And a little later, I came back, and he was curled up in a chair by his grandfather's door and crying into the cushion of the chair. And I said, but, Buzzy, I told you to go find a bathtub. And I couldn't find any bathtub empty.
Well, Buzzy certainly was growing up in the Roosevelt tradition, wasn't it?
And I always laughed about that because I knew it grew entirely out of this tradition, which had come primarily from my grandmother, purely as a social thing. You didn't make yourself an unpleasant companion, you see. You were pleasant. And if you had to be unpleasant, you retired and stayed away from people.
Do you remember as a little girl having to cry alone very often?
Well, I was not a very happy little girl. I was alone a great deal, this little girl. And I don't think I often indulged in tears. I lived in books very largely, and I can remember reading books and crying over them. I can remember retiring to an attic room in the house of Tivoli, where I lived with my grandmother, and reading a book called Misunderstood, which nobody nowadays reads, and sitting on the floor of the attic room, just crying a whole rainy afternoon through the book. But I don't think I probably cried very much myself. It was too strict a discipline. You couldn't do that and be what you were expected to be.
I wonder how the discipline dealt with the shyness that you must have felt even as a child.
Well, I think it all went together. I was always shy. I never got over being shy. But I was less shy because I had to see a great many more people in my grandmother's house. I had young aunts and young uncles, and I had to see them, that's all. And then I went abroad to school, and I got over my shyness to a great extent in school and became more confident of myself there. Then I, of course, had a terrific recurrence of it when I came back and found that I was supposed to go out in New York society, and I didn't know a soul. I'd been 3 years in Europe. I had no girlfriends left. I didn't know a single man, except an old friend of my mother's and my aunt, Mrs. Cole's, called Bob Ferguson, who was an Englishman, but who lived all of his life. He became an American in order to go with the Rough Riders with Uncle Ted. And he was an old friend of the family's. And the first ball I went to in New York, he was the only man I knew in the room. I'd been gone for 3 years. I didn't have any girls that I knew left. I didn't have any men left. I had an aunt who was a belle. Everybody knew her and everybody loved her, and she was very pretty. And I was not pretty at all and not noticeable, and I didn't know so.
Which aunt was that, Mrs. Roosevelt?
Edith Hall. She's over there on the wall. Do you see her?
Oh, yes.
The very top is old Mrs. Ludlow, and underneath her is Mrs. Forbes Morgan.
Oh, yes. One of the pictures I've enjoyed so much of your family archives is this one.
My mother, you see.
That is such
she
a beautiful...
She was very beautiful. She was Anna Hall.
Yes.
Very beautiful.
And I thought this lady, too.
That's my great-grandmother, Ludlow, who was a Livingston. And she was a character, a real character, with a very hot temper. And my grandmother Hall was her youngest child and was completely dominated by her. I mean, if she told her to come, she got up out of a sick bed and came.
Well, the Halls, as well as the Roosevelts, apparently, were a family to reckon with, weren't they?
Yes, I think they all were.
Well, I enjoyed your reference to one of your children. You didn't specify which one it was, who went to Paris, I believe, to
Franken,
visit...
It was Franken, who went to stay with Tizzy, Mrs. Mortimer. She's right. That one with the little girl on her lap. Mm-hmm. She had a shooting in Scotland 1 year, and both Johnny and Franken went to stay with her. And Franken said to me afterwards, "I don't know why you never told us about the Halls." Well, it was bad enough to be Roosevelts on two sides, but when you add the Halls, I don't know what you could expect of us. And then he went on to say how she had walked the moors with them every morning and sat up and played poker with them every night, and apparently was able to do everything, and he just couldn't get over.
How much of an influence was your Uncle Ted on you?
He was the first person to throw me into the water to try to make me swim, and he had to fish me out again because I didn't swim. And he was very indignant. And then he would take all the children to Oyster Bay up to the top of Cooper's Bluff and line us up with the youngest at the tail end, and he would lead. And Cooper's Bluff was like a very high sand dune, very steep. And at high tide, the water was the bottom, but at low tide, there was a beach. And then he would run down just as fast as possible, and then you had to climb back again. And you slipped back about 2 feet for every one you climbed up. And it seemed an endless climb to me, but you had to race to see who would get back the quickest. And that was a terrific ordeal, but I I learned to bear with it. And what I loved that he did was to read us old Norse sagas or poetry of many kinds. And he would do that when he took us on picnics or on a rainy day up in what he called the gun room, which was where he kept all his guns and things in the top floor of the house at Sagamore. And I think, on the whole, that the pleasure overweighed the pain, but there was a good deal of pain because I felt very inadequate to many of the things that we did. There would be obstacle races which would take us through haystacks, and I was always worried as to what I would find in the haystack. And I never liked snakes, and he always allowed the boys to collect snakes and carry them round in their blouses, and then they would bring them out just because they knew I didn't like snakes. But it was good for me, and my brother just adored it and was much better fitted to it than I was.
It's so incredible looking back from this vantage point where you see the schism, as it were, in the Roosevelt families in the light of your husband's presidency. But at the time that you were a girl, what was the general atmosphere among the entire Roosevelt clan?
Well, my husband had been brought up a Democrat. Of course, all the Roosevelts were Democrats originally. Mm-hmm. And then Theodore Roosevelt and Franklin's father, too, had become Lincoln Republicans. The Theodore Roosevelts stayed Republicans, mm-hmm. but Franklin's father and Theodore Roosevelt's senior's brother went back to being Democrats. And so that my immediate family, my father and his brother Theodore Roosevelt, grew up as Republicans and the others as Democrats.
So that actually you were raised in a Republican household.
Oh, I was raised as a Republican. I followed Uncle Ted because he was my uncle, do you see? And when I knew he was in politics or he'd gone to the war or whatever it might be, I naturally was interested in what he was doing. But I'm quite sure that when I went abroad at the age of 15, I really didn't know what the difference was between the two parties. It wasn't until I was married that I really got a clear idea of what the difference was. Before that, I'd always just followed Uncle Ted blindly.
But apparently there was a very clear consciousness of distinction between the branches.
Oh, yes. Oh, my, yes. But Auntie Corinne and Uncle Ted himself were always very kind to my husband. They were always very kind to him, and Uncle Ted always took a great interest in him because he felt that he had interested him in going into public life. And he had a great influence on Frank.
And did your husband think highly of Uncle Ted's presidency?
Oh, yes. He voted for Uncle Ted.
Did he?
Oh, yes.
Although, actually, looking back at it, President Theodore Roosevelt was barely a Republican in the orthodox sense of the term.
Yes, he was much nearer a Democrat.
And he actually gave you away, didn't he, at your wedding?
Yes, at my wedding, oh yes. We were married on St. Patrick's Day because it was the day he could come to New York. Of course, it was very funny because people were much more interested in seeing the president than they were in seeing the bride and groom. So suddenly, after everybody had passed, we were left all alone. So we went and joined the others and listened to the president telling stories.
You were upstaged at your own wedding?
Yes, we were.
As I sit here, Mrs. Roosevelt, I'm looking directly at what I think is a beautiful photograph of your mother-in-law.
Yes, it is.
When was that taken? I can't see the date from here.
Well, that was taken quite a number of years before she died, but she was already quite an old lady then.
That's
she lived to be 86, you see.
Yes, I know.
She died in the autumn of 41, before mm-hmm. the war, before we were in the war. And my husband was always, in a way, I think, relieved that she died before we really were in the war, because he said she would have felt so badly when her grandsons had to go to the war.
Yes.
And in addition, he felt that her way of life was coming to an end and that there would never be that way of life in the United States again. And he said she would have found it so hard to adjust to another kind of living. And I think that's quite true.
I think it's eminently true.
So that I think in many ways, though he missed her a great deal, I think he felt it was easier for her to die when she died, which was in September of
41.
Mm.
Well, historically, I think the relationship between you and your mother-in-law is such an interesting one. And I wonder now, in perspective and in looking back at the whole panorama of years ever since your marriage, what evaluation do you have now of the relationship that you had with your mother-in-law?
Well, she was a very remarkable woman in many ways. She was a very strong character, and she had what I think that generation had to a far greater degree than most modern generations have had. She was very sure that she was convinced that the pattern of right and wrong was as she had seen it and grown up and been bred in it. And, of course, having that feeling, she was very unwilling to allow others to do what she felt was unwise. Now, she had a different attitude towards life. It was the attitude of a very great lady who'd grown up to certain privileges, but had with them a great sense of responsibility. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you saw to it that you helped people who were in trouble or who needed help in any way, and you tried to contribute to your community, whatever you could. And I think she did a great deal that was very fine and had a very fine influence on her son, but it was not the influence that led to the kind of development that he was heading towards. So it was always, to me, later in life, a very interesting thing, because in a way, she and her husband gave my husband the best kind of training for the life he was going to live. And yet I don't think they had, either of them had the slightest desire to see him live that kind of life, or the slightest idea that they were preparing him for it. Now, I've been told by people that she thought of him as possibly becoming president. I've never believed that was so. Mm-hmm. It may be, of course, but I just can't imagine that she ever thought that he would take part in political life, because I remember when he first agreed to run for the state senate, she was really very much surprised.
Was she opposed to it?
I don't think she was really opposed to it, though I think she would have preferred if he'd gone on in his law firm and become a well-established lawyer. But she was not opposed exactly. Well, she sometimes was very much opposed to things he did and never hesitated to tell him. But he was very amusing in many ways. He was very like her and had a streak of Dutch stubbornness. And so when he didn't agree, he wouldn't say so, but he just went right ahead in his own way. And he had an enormous admiration for her. He was devoted to her. But if there was a subject which was bothering both of them, I mean, that they knew they disagreed on, you couldn't leave them together for long, because they always fought.
Well, now, I wanted to ask you about the individual perspectives toward the problem and the natural family problem of strong personalities all being united in marriage. I'm sure that your husband was aware of the problems that you faced as being the daughter-in-law of a woman with strong conviction.
Yes, but he had a very interesting philosophy. If something was unpleasant and he didn't want to know about it, he just ignored it, and he never talked about it.
Did he feel confident that you could handle it?
I think he always thought that if you ignored a thing long enough, it would settle itself.
But it must have been very difficult for you in the early years.
Not in the early years, because in the early years I did exactly what she told me. It took me quite a number of years to emancipate myself at all. And then when I finally did emancipate myself, that was the time when she was unhappy. And she was very unhappy when I began to earn some money of my own. She was very unhappy about that.
Had she ever become reconciled to the idea?
Never quite, mm-hmm. never. And when I've had this as a factory, and then when I turned it into a house, and occasionally, when Franklin was not coming up, instead of staying with her, I stayed over here. She was always miserable. She said, I cannot understand how you prefer living in a hovel to living with me.